Okay, so we come to the last part of this chapter, and along with it, the last part of the camp, except that tomorrow there'll be a summary as we do always. So, now we come to, Shobindu is taking up each and every idea, and this idea of cosmic illusion, as I said, it's so strange. If you say it's a meaningless illusion which has just somehow come, then who is going to tell this to whom and why? Because ultimately it makes no sense at all. The only thing is, okay, you wake up to the reality and all this illusion, end of the story. But the very idea that you have to tell everyone that this is a maya, this is a play, and so it doesn't make sense. So it is a paradox in itself. So as we have seen, what we call as illusion is basically, and we compare with the dream state, which is a much better analogy, is that it is the dream of the dreamer. But is he a helpless dreamer? If he is a helpless dreamer, one can understand that he himself is trapped into it. But here comes this idea that he is not a helpless dreamer. There is the omniscient, omnipotent power of his. What is known as Maya is in its origin Shakti. So what is she doing? She is realizing the dreams that are there in the Supreme, if you want to put it dream, but here it will be more accurate, possibilities. That's why we see the perfect relation between Sri Aurobindo and the mother. And the mother says, so beautifully summarizes it. I think that summarizes the entire idea or understanding of Maya and Brahman or Ishwara and Shakti. She says, without him, I exist not. Without me, he is unmanifest. And that's the simplest way to understand this whole thing. So, but to cut off that one reality from the entire manifestation, technically we can say that it exists before, if we can use the word before, even that won't apply. Because time and space are not yet there when the Shakti starts the play. So we can't even use the word before the manifestation began. This is a human language. That's why in all Vedantic scriptures, when you read about Prakriti, it says that, well, Prakriti is as much constant in motion as the divine himself, except that it is in motion and that is static. But you can't say one day suddenly that reality said, okay, let's do something, and out of himself there emerged the Shakti. That's not true. What is true is Shakti was always there inside, and Shakti is always manifesting within, around, outside. And what is she manifesting? She is manifesting what is there inherent in the infinite as possibilities. Why she is manifesting it? Because ultimately, ekoham bahushyam, the one wants to become many. And what is the code word of the play? Bliss. If you find delight, yes, it's actually a play of delight, but it takes time to understand. So this is the basic thing of this whole process. Of course, one can cut it and go back. But if you say this is the only truth, that's what Sri Aurobindo is contending, it won't be correct. In fact, it is less correct. It's almost like saying, as I said, that the painter and the painting. The painter says, I don't owe any responsibility for my painting. Actually, you know what? I am not even a painter. I am just a human being. Actually, you know what? I am not even a human being. But somehow this painting has come into existence through the instrumentality of my hands. That's a very crooked way of going about. But the painter can say, yes, I exist independent of the painting, but the painting is an extension of me, which is a more complete and most accurate statement. Now you may understand the painting in 10 different ways. That's a different story. He will say very simply, if we go and try to understand the painting, you will say, hold on, I have not yet finished. Bas. Sir, when will you finish it? You'll say, Sri Aurobindo has told you, isn't it? Supramental creation is going to come. Sir, how long will it take? He'll say, just thoda, quietly, you sit, I am doing it. Sir, what will be the painting like? It'll be very beautiful beyond what anything you can imagine. Now, that would make sense that, well, the painting is still incomplete. We are caught midway and we are drawing all our conclusions. So that's where he will come to, and he takes now when he speaks of hallucination. As I said, it's a very beautiful chapter with plenty of, I mean, each page, but we'll take up some of the images which have been used. So page 446, one of the images, an example of the first. So there are two things, that there is ideative and visual hallucination. So ideative is there is nothing really, and you are perceiving things. The second is visual. There is something and you are seeing something else. So there are two ways of looking at it. And he says an example of the first is the mirage. There is no water and you are seeing. So is it this kind of illusion? Well, water exists somewhere. You are not seeing some original something. This one. But Maya's action is absolutely original. Omnipotent, omniscient. So mind can say like that. It sees the water. The second is, an example of the second is the classic instance of the rope taken for a snake. Here there is a visual hallucination that I'm not going into psychiatric definitions because that's a very limited thing. There is something which the mind is interpreting as a snake. So, and so a few lines below he says, but taking only the common hallucination, mental or visual, we observe that it seems to be at first sight a true example of what is called imposition in the philosophic theory, that Maya has imposed itself on Brahman. It looks like that. It is the placement of an unreal figure of things on a reality, of a mirage upon the bare desert air, of the figure of a non-present snake on the present and real rope. The world, we may contend, is such a hallucination, an imposition of a non-existent, unreal figure of things on the bare, ever-present soul reality of the Brahman. See, if you just quote this sentence, see, Shurabindu is also saying Mayavad. This is the problem of quoting. All kinds of things get quoted, and nowadays, you know, people make nice slides and send it across. But hold on, this is he developing an argument. He's saying, you may say like that, but, he goes further, but then we note that in each case, the hallucination, the false image is not of something quite non-existent. It is an image of something existent and real, but not present in the place on which it has been imposed by the mind's error or by his sense error. He's saying there is an original creation of things. You can't say that is also a hallucination. Mind is seeing something. It may not be the right thing. That's understandable. But already there exists. It's not like world exists because I see it like this, because it amounts to that. The world exists much before man comes into existence, man sees. So this whole idea that, you know, man has to come out of this Maya, this world exists much before us. We may misrepresent things, that the mind, and that he'll take us later. A mirage is the image of a city, an oasis, running water, or of other absent things. And if these things did not exist, the false image of them, whether raised up by the mind or reflected in the desert air, would not be there to delude the mind with a false sense of reality. So these images exist. That's how we are using. So this analogy is inadequate. Right now he is challenging that analogy. A snake exists, and its existence and form are known to the victim of the momentary hallucination. So you can't say there is no suffering, no sorrow, no hostility, hostile forces, no asura, no deva. They exist. Their action is real. And people do suffer from that. Yes, you may say that this was a harmless fellow and you saw an asura in him. That's common enough. That when you are going into a state of asura yourself, you start seeing asura everywhere. That's a different thing altogether. Similarly, equally, when you are living in the state of divine, you will see the divine everywhere. But these things exist, and the mind may get imposed upon the mind. The analogy, therefore, is unhelpful. It would be valid only if our image of the universe were a falsity, reflecting a true universe which is not here, but elsewhere, or else if it were a false imaged manifestation of the reality, replacing in the mind or covering with its distorted resemblance a true manifestation. It's a very far-stretched hypothesis that there is no table. Even the most avowed Mayavadin who says he has realized Brahman, that's what I said in the beginning, that because this is an unsolvable riddle, so they use the word practical. Practically, why you have to deal with it practically? How does it matter? I mean, actually speaking, but you have to deal with it. It is clear that in this analogy, two quite different kinds of illusion, not illustrative of each other, are mistakenly put together as if they were identical in nature. So he again puts this theory aside. Those who want the detail, you will get all the detailed arguments. But I'll just read this last one. The analogy of mental hallucination would only be applicable if we admit a Brahman without names, forms or relations, and a world of names, forms and relations as equal realities imposed one upon the other, because that reality is somewhere. So you can say it has imposed itself on Brahman, which means there is no real Advaita, which means there are two orders of realities, which are possibly independent. Not possibly, they are independent of each other. So it creates a problem. The rope in the place of the snake, or the snake in the place of the rope, an attribution, it might be, of the activities of the saguna to the quiescence of the nirgun. This is the ultimate explanation given. So, of the nirgun. But if both are real, both must be either separate aspects of the reality or coordinate aspects, positive and negative poles of the one existence. So either you have to say that there is a nirgun existence, Brahman, and there is a sagun Brahman, both equal in their own right, or you have to say they are two sides of one reality. That's why Sri Ramakrishna put it very nicely. He said, you take a, of course, these are all images. You take a stick and you move it from one side to another. There is no resistance. There is nothing in between. That is nirgun. And you move it from the other side. It meets with something which is there, is sagun. They are two sides of one reality. This comes in synthesis of yoga in every place. So there is one reality. One which is unmanifest. It has within it all the possibilities. And the second which is manifest. Don't make a unbridgeable distinction between the two. They are two orders of reality, but they are one in the consciousness of the one, in whom both nirgun and sagun, the formless and the form, exist together. Manifest is bringing out of the unmanifest. If we understand it, because that's what we experience in life. Many things are unmanifest, they come into manifestation in our own life. So this is where we are taken. And then finally, another image which is used is the one and the many. So he says it's only a reflection, pratibhas. And this is a common, if you read the Vedantic literature, they'll say there is no individual soul. The many souls is like the Chandrama reflecting, the moon reflecting in the ocean, looks many. But actually there is only one moon. This would be true if all the souls were exactly the same, doing the same thing, like a typical Babuji's office where everybody is wearing the same dress, same collar, everything. But that's not true. In reality, each one has its own unique aspect, unique development, unique line of experience. Even when one experiences the divine, there is a unique line along which one goes. So, if you give this analogy, then again diversity remains completely unexplained, because diversity has no meaning. By mistake, there is a feeling, there is an individual soul. It raises many other questions, that if there is no reality of the individual soul, then who really gets freedom to start with? So here comes this other analogy of one and the many. Page 448. The one appearing as many, but upon that is imposed an immense organized diversity in nature, a diversity of forms and movements which have nothing to do with the original real. Dreams, Visions, the imagination of the artist or poet can present such an organized diversity which is not real, but it is an imitation, a mimesis of a real and already existent organized diversity. All these things exist as bhava within us, as possibilities within us, and each one is again, each soul is following one line of the infinite possibilities within the one who is infinite. So this argument also he develops. What we see in the universe is that a diversity of the identical is everywhere, the fundamental operation of cosmic nature. But here it presents itself not as an illusion, but as a various real formation out of a one original substance. So that's where, and as I said, one can go to any. Now comes this aspect that means there is something somewhere which is intervening and giving form to things. So this is another argument which is given. It's all the play of the mind. They don't use the word Maya. They see it is the mind. Now you can't say human mind because creation is before the human mind. So this is explained by saying there is an original cosmic mind which has nothing to do with the creator. There are different theories. We need not go into that. So it is the mind which has given form to the formless. And if you compare that mind to the human mind, then of course it seems that must be prone to error. So he brings in, it doesn't explain things, but still to an extent. Thus, this at once raises the question of the nature of mind, the parent of these illusions, and its relation to the original existence. So Shobindo has used the word in Savitri, mind is a mediator divinity. Mother has used the word, it's a form maker. This is the Daksha Prajapati. If we go to the Indian thought, so there is Mahadev, the eternal. And there is the Daksha Prajapati who is a form maker. He arranges things according to his own logic. And according to his own logic, ultimately, Mahadev shows him his place, that his logic is going contrary to original impulse because he removes Sati. It's a very interesting story. That without that power, he wants to create by his own, because that power has gone into the yajna. And then creation begins to go backward because the goat head is fixed backward. So all these are stories which are trying to convey some deeper truth. So what is the role of the mind? So one thing is clear, if we compare the mind with our own mind, then yes, our mind is very limited. So we make that mistake. The moment it is said, oh, it is the mind which has created. Now we immediately think, mind, okay, my mind. It's not about your mind which is being spoken about. So he'll take us step by step. Our mind is a limited operation. So he says that, well, our own mind at any rate is not an original and primary creative power of consciousness. It is, and all mind of the same character must be, derivative, an instrumental demiurge, an intermediary creator. Few lines below, page 449. Our mind stands between a superconscience and an inconscience and receives from both these opposite powers. It stands between an occult subliminal existence and an outward cosmic phenomenon. It receives inspirations, intuitions, imaginations, impulses to knowledge and action, figures of subjective realities or possibilities from the unknown inner source. So it may receive intimation from the superconscient, it may receive intimations from the inconscient. Mind is a mediator divinity. It is the Babu sitting in between, the Malik and the recipient. So we must understand the role and nature of the mind. And so we come to page 450. Mind creates, but it is not an original creator. I have used it as a game when I read this. I said, can I imagine something which doesn't exist anywhere? I'll give this as an exercise. Supposing you say, Udane wala ghoda. The wings exist, the horse exists. That's why Shri Aurobindo says, Earth's winged chimeras are truth steeds in heaven. Uchchaishava. Try. I mean, imagining something which is non-existent. May not be existing right now in the physical world, but you will use all kinds of permutations, combinations from some kind of, you know, existing images and make something which you will say is new. But it's not new. It is still the same. You have permutations, combinations, one is combined. It's a very interesting exercise. After some time you sleep into trance. Very nice, huh? Because all kinds of images will come up. Maya, the illusive, so mind creates, but it is not an original creator. Maya, the illusive power, on the contrary, must be an original creator. For it creates all things out of nothing. There are things which never were, not even in imagination. And they came into existence and they went away. There was a time when there was not even a semblance of man. And suddenly, you know, man emerges out of the beast. That Maya does. But if we have to do, we'll make a four-legged creature stand. Again, you will end up with two hands like that horse. What is that called? Centaurs. Those things you can do. Permutation and combinations. But original creation is with Maya. Unless we suppose that it creates out of the substance of the reality. But then the thing it creates must be in some way real. So that's how Sri Aurobindo speaks of that in Savitri. That if we say the world is a dream, it is a dream fact vision of truth. That there is something there in the possibilities of the infinite out of which it is creating. Then it makes sense. And then everything makes sense, everything is put in place, because then we have to make this dream perfect, more attuned, receive the right inspiration, right intimation, right intuition and shape. Even if we don't, eventually world has a future. But if we subtract that Maya is a power which has come randomly and it's just throwing out images out of nowhere. And actually if we see, it is very simple exercise, you know, anything in this universe. You can, I mean, even if one has not read the Gita where it describes in the Vibhuti chapter where Shri Krishna says everything, he at some point he connects it with himself as the Lord, as the womb of all things. So even including people who are playing the game of dice, cunning, who are cheating. He says, I am the intelligence of the cunning. What is he using? He's using intelligence. Where does it come from? The source of intelligence. Asura is using only force. Where does it come from? Comes from the force of Sachidananda. So it is drawing and making so many possibilities. So that's how one has to understand the action of Maya. It limits, and it limits slow. So that slowly one day, that he is not revealing here, the secret. The finite form, which is a limited form, can manifest the infinite, which is what the Isha Upanishad says, which is where we come back of Mata Sita's holding a thread and telling Ravan, this you dare to cross. This possibility exists. Because in the finite, the infinite is there. Infinite consciousness. And see, in India we had understood this so well. You pick up a stone. See, we forgot this. But all the Namazis remember it. So anywhere they will construct a mosque. But there was a time when you could go anywhere, suddenly you'll see a small little stone and people prayed. Why? Because anything and everything has the divine. You can use anything for, because that is the original truth. So Maya is not acting completely independently de novo. She is drawing from that. When you look at the mountain, it is a mountain, but it is also the symbol of tapasya. When we look at the river, it is the river, but it's also the river of life. Where does life originate from? Where is tapasya originate from? From the one divine. And we can use it for every image in the world. And that's why Indian spiritual thought went to what extent? Worship of cow, lion, quiet power, tiger, stealth power. power which is full of cunning and ruse. Ultimately, all power comes from the Divine Mother. So you see, one form of the Divine Mother, Divine Mother is on a lion. But there is another form which is on a tiger. So you see different aspects. Each aspect, actually, it's a long subject, can ultimately be attributed to the one divine reality. What about the grass? What about the trina? Hay? Well, who is more humble than the divine? Humblest of the humble. Vastest of the vast. And all else in between is a manifestation of the divine. And who is doing this? The omnipotent, omniscient Maya. It's all happening between the two of them. We fellows are just somewhere, you know, caught in between. And it says, okay, she's feeling amused, like when, between the parents, they have decided that, you know, today we'll have this meal cooking. And the little child comes, sees, interferes. But ultimately, she's making a meal. So that is how we, when we look at it, life becomes very simple. Maya has a role. And that's why without Maya, you cannot find the Brahman completely. That's why in typical Radha Krishna, there is a whole, if you follow Tantra, you can't go to the ultimate reality without the Divine Mother. And in there is a whole sect, I'm forgetting which one, is it Gaudiya Sampradaya? Maybe. Anyway, so I can't vouchsafe for it. Where without Radha, you cannot find Krishna. Her blessing has to be there. Because she has created this universe. She knows Krishna. It's out of him that she has created for his pleasure, for his joy, for his... So if you want to go out, she will consult. Kya kare bacche ko? If he says, not bichara, he's not ready to go through the whole play, then you are out. You remember how she, Nalinikant Gupta, he writes that he tried to take sannyas 3 times. All 3 times it didn't work out. Divine Mother didn't allow. There is a work he has to do. Even if we take Sri Ramakrishna, that, you know, when Ma Sharda says that I have, Divine Mother has put a veil deliberately on Narendra, otherwise he'll run away. That means they are both in perfect collusion. Divine Mother will not let him come back to Brahman. She has the key. The key is with her. And that's what we see in... But even this is a half statement. Because then why has she started? That's manifestation. It's not there. Ultimately, it ends up with some understanding of, you know, she has made the play, but she has the key to for you to come out. But that's not the purpose of the play. And that's, then she would not have made such a difficult play. She would have made an easy play where you go and if you want to come out, say, hey God, I'm here, and you know, he pulls you in. But it's not as simple as that. So there is a purpose in the Mighty Mother's random play. There is a meaning, and that we have to decipher. But that is not the subject of this chapter. So on page 451, but our mind has the faculty of imagination. So he's saying that if you take the analogy of the mind, mind imagines things. You can imagine anything. Now comes the catch. It can create and take as true and real its own mental structures. Here it might be thought is something analogous to the action of Maya. Our mental imagination is an instrument of ignorance. Mind supplements these deficiencies by its power of imagination, because it cannot know everything. It uses it to extract from things obvious and visible the things that are not obvious and visible. It undertakes to create its own figures of the possible and the impossible. Many of the images of gods and, mind has created in its own way. It erects illusory actuals or draws figures of a conjectured or constructed truth of things that are not true to outer appearance. Buddha will say, yes, that's what I'm trying to point at. But we have to wait. Sri Aurobindo is just saying this is, he is accepting this part, but he will complete it. But in reality, it is the mind's way or one of its ways of summoning out of being its infinite possibilities. even of discovering or capturing the unknown possibilities of the infinite. But because it cannot do this with knowledge, it makes experimental constructions. So it says that it's not that, you know, again it is going back to the infinite from whom things are coming. See, this one word changes everything. If you use the word only one, then there is a problem, because for one, for us, one is one unit. But the moment we understand that one is infinite, then it makes sense. Every possibility is there in the one. Just like the number one. You can multiply, you can divide, you can add, you can minus, you can keep on doing 1, 1, 1 and reach infinite. So 1 and 0 are the numbers, even technically we are using, because somewhere intuitively it is true that these are the two primary things. In fact, all imaginations represent possibilities. Now comes another great truth. Imagination can open the door to a greater reality. All guided imagery is that. Some are able one day to actualize in some form, perhaps a very different form of actuality. So we had the famous song, forget the singer and the dancer, that was not so important, but he used the word, there's a famous song, Imagine. That song caught a whole generation. And he started with, imagine a world without boundaries. Now human mind has caught that. And slowly we will move toward that today or tomorrow. A world without money. People imagined. So imagination is simply something wrong or rubbish. You can use it. And if you use it, it's the most powerful tool to open doors to those things which are not yet. Rational mind cannot do it, but imagination can do it. So there it says, different from, more are condemned to sterility because they do not enter into the figure or scheme of the present creation, do not come within the permitted potentiality of the individual, or do not accord with the collective or the generic principle, or are alien to the nature or destiny of the containing world existence. There are people who imagine a most beautiful world. Aa chal ke tujhe main leke chaloon ek aise gagan ke tale, aansu bhi na ho, gham bhi na ho, bas pyar hi pyar pale. Achha gana likha hai. But this is the reality of tomorrow. Human mind, it has entered into the mind of the race that there will be one day a world where there will be no more strife and discord. So we'll say, sir, hold on. You know what is happening in Gaza? Yes. I know what is happening in Gaza. But somebody's imagined. That's why Shrivinda says, French Revolution, where did it start? A yogi sitting in Himalaya dreamed of freedom, equality and fraternity. That's the story of Vasishth. Suddenly armies arise, and not only they defeat Vishwamitra, they come all the way down into the plains of India. Shobindo connects that event, because that power, that Atmbal, which he released that time. And so every possible Vishwamitra who gets very proud and who thinks he is everything, it's not just about one Vishwamitra. And see, he too has a chance. So that's why the whole story unfolds now. Resisting the temptation of Vishwamitra's story. But it's so amazing. He gave the Gayatri Mantra. One should read his story. How he changed through a series of situations and circumstances. And but it is to be noted that though the... Okay, possibilities. Thus the mind's imaginations are not purely and actually illusory. That's what he is coming to say. There are either things in the present but not actualized in this way, or there are things which are of the future which have not realized today. So many things in our life. So everybody who is crying about a relationship, please, probably you have a hope. So this is a way to say. Who knows? But in another way, because the mind, that's where. Another way is that everybody may one day discover we are all brothers and sisters. So distortion comes, mine, exclusive, this the ego comes. But when we read the mother's writings and Savitri, and there it says that so beautifully that we all will dwell together with the one divine mother all around her, building her world. But today we fight because that possibility has not come, because there are distortions. The moment love steps in, there is claim. Claim is only the divine can claim anybody. And with the claim comes distortion. And it is needed for now, the ego's play. Otherwise people will say, "Pir kya fayda? Why should I love anyone?" This is the problem. So you have to go through that experience toward that universality of love. You cannot embody universal love, and humanity has to be prepared. But that is the eventual truth. So this is just an example. And so toward the end, even he says, for example, page 453, this is what we were referring to. The mind creates the figure of mermaid, of a mermaid. By the way, they exist, huh? Okay, figure of a mermaid. But the fantasy is composed of two actualities put together in a way that is outside the earth's normal potentiality. Angels, griffins, chimeras are constructed on the same principle. Sometimes the imagination is a memory of former actualities, as in the mythical figure of the dragon. Sometimes it is a figure or a happening that is real or could be real on other planes or in other conditions of existence, and sometimes it is the reality of the future. So basically it means we must use our imaginations very carefully, because what we imagine, imagination is a great power. It is rubbish. It's all imagination. It's a much greater power than reason. And if we misuse it, we are creating it, opening doors to it sometime, somewhere. So we should imagine beautiful things. Doesn't matter, they are not there. They may manifest tomorrow. So this is the power of imagination. In the last passage on page 454. But before that, finally, page 453. Mind is, and last 7-8 lines from below. Mind is an instrument of the cosmic ignorance, but it does not seem to be or does not act like a power or an instrument of a cosmic illusion. So he says there is a cosmic truth and there is a cosmic ignorance. But ignorance is not illusion. Ignorance is that you tell a child, make a hippopotamus. Now he has never seen hippopotamus. You give a basic measure, so he ends up making a fat horse. So he doesn't know. That is ignorance. But there is the truth of the horse behind. There is the truth of the hippopotamus behind. So the mind mistranslates the messages. So it's a cosmic ignorance, which is not equal to illusion as a non-existent reality. And equally, there is a cosmic truth, and that truth is Maya. I mean, Vidyamay Maya, if you like. In the ancient text, it is Vidyamay Maya is cosmic truth and the Vidyamay is cosmic ignorance. It is a seeker and discoverer or a creator or would be creator of truth's possibilities and actualities, the mind. And it would be rational to suppose that the original consciousness and power from which mind must be a derivation is also a creator of truth's possibilities and actualities, not limited like mind, but cosmic in its scope, not open to error because free from all ignorance, a sovereign instrument or a self-power of a supreme omniscience and omnipotence and eternal wisdom and knowledge. This then is the dual possibility that arises before us. There is, we may suppose, an original consciousness and power, creative of illusions and unrealities with mind as its instrument or medium in the human and animal consciousness, so that the differentiated universe we see is unreal, a fiction of Maya, and only some indeterminable and undifferentiated absolute is real. This is one possibility. Again, pick up this sentence and see, Shobindu is confirming Mayavad. Now we have to see the second possibility. Because he's speaking to us in an intellectual language of the rational. So what is the second? The second, or there is, we may equally suppose, an original, a supreme or cosmic truth consciousness. He's using words like suppose because he can't say I have experienced it. He's taking us logically. A cosmic truth consciousness creative of a true universe, but with mind acting in that universe as an imperfect consciousness. It's ignorant, partly knowing, partly not knowing, a consciousness which is by its ignorance or limitation of knowledge capable of error, misrepresentation, mistaken or misdirected development from the known, of uncertain gropings towards the unknown, of partial creations and buildings, a constant half position between mind, truth and error, knowledge and nescience. So mind is a mediator divinity. That's where he is coming to. But this ignorance in fact proceeds, however stumblingly, upon knowledge and towards knowledge. This is the saving grace. It is inherently capable of shedding the limitation, the mixture, and can turn by that liberation into the truth consciousness, into a power of the original knowledge. Example, husband, wife, when they meet together, first few years, lovely. Then fight. Now if they go through the process, they become best of, you know, literally best of friends. Because all these things which were, this is mine, that is yours, is gone. And they become a support to each other. At least this is what should happen if the lawyer and well-meaning friends don't intervene. If you let things grow and evolve, they will evolve towards something as children of the Divine Mother, who have been brought together with a certain purpose, which makes life so beautiful. Then all the rest becomes all, mind is misreading the message and thinking this is mine and that is yours. That is the misreading. But in truth, they've been brought together with a certain work, divine work. And their truth lies in the divine. So there is a cosmic truth and a cosmic ignorance. I'm just giving a common example with which at least married people can connect, or most people can connect even if they are not married. Because, people go through this experience one way or the other. And everywhere you can see this example. As I said, before the Thomas Alva Edison discovered the bulb, he failed number of times. Supposing he left it halfway through. I am only fool thinking such a thing is possible. Then what will happen? Somebody else will get the idea and do it. Because that truth was pressing upon the earth. And God said, let there be light, and there was light. The fiat had gone. He persisted. So many of us give up. We become deluded or sad, despondent. We never try to correct and evolve and grow. That, well, this was the ignorant part, and that's what Mother says. We have to extract that little ingot of gold from all the mixture that is around. So in everything there is a grain of truth. Extract that. Keep it. That's the wealth. But because we are not ready directly for that grain of truth, so we keep on gathering hay, and in between suddenly, Gyari, Sona chipa hai. Chipa hai, har cheez mein. But aapko uske liye, you have to, labor patiently. So this is where he is leading us. But this ignorance in fact proceeds, however stumblingly, upon knowledge and towards knowledge. Our inquiry has so far led rather to the second direction, which is what we are reading now. That mind is a mediator, its constructions, it is open to truth, it's open to ignorance, and from ignorance it's moving towards truth. Toward the conclusion that the nature of our consciousness is not of a character that would justify the hypothesis of a cosmic illusion as the solution of its problem. A problem exists, but it consists in the mixture of knowledge with ignorance, in recognition of self and things, and it is the origin of this imperfection that we have to discover. There is no need of bringing in an original power of illusion, always mysteriously existent in the eternal reality, or else intervening and imposing, a world of non-existent forms on a consciousness or super conscience that is forever pure, eternal and absolute. What he's saying is that what we do is throw the baby with the bathwater. If we had a very horrible experience in love, let us say, we say love is meaningless, love is jo main aiso janati preet kiye dukh hoye nagar dhindora peetti preet na kije koi. Mirabai sang, no, that if I knew that love will lead to this state, I would have told everybody never, never love anyone. And what she says in the next line, Eri mein to prem diwani mero darad na jaane koi. But what is the difference? Meera never gave up. So, as this is one of her earlier writings, at the end, what does she say? She says, Mero to giridhar gopal dusro na koi. Tat mat bat bhrat band dusro na koi. Then she discovered that what she was seeking when she discovered, says, he is my everything, my father, mother, brother, sister, and one can equally say to complete what Mirabai discovered, that in father, mother, sister, brother, wife, husband, I can equally discover the one divine, which is the great truth of the Brihadaranyak. When Yajnavalkya is asked by Maitreyi, why does one love the wife? Why does one love the child? Why does one love? And he says, not for the sake of the wife or the child that one loves the wife or the child, but for the sake of the self. And Shobindu gives us the ultimate meaning. He says, when we are in the ego self, the smallest, then we love them for the ego self. How they can satisfy me? But when we are in the greater self, we don't love them for that they are not satisfying me. Go, get lost. We will get into that problem again. Because that seeking for perfection is there. So the second aspect is that loving, that for the sake of the greater self, means the wife, child, friend, they are all for the divine, meant to disclose the divine within them. Maybe our coming together may be a help in that process, and then life changes. Jayama, we complete today.